software movement is so very, and I guess there is some good too far from this machine. Important in much wider ways in our society. I'd like to look at two different sort of things which quickly will turn around two basic themes. The first theme is really the question of, and you've heard already quite a bit about it from Philippe, it's the question of infrastructure. And the other one is the question of individualism, how it is being reshaped in this very moment in history. So let's start a little bit, if you want, with the infrastructure approach. When the free software movement began, many people, and I've talked to Georgina about that once for a long time, many people were thinking that really the whole point of that was really to create some very fundamental pieces of the puzzle, the computer puzzle, so as to ensure some sort of stable, basic, accessible platform for everybody. In effect, the reason why big companies recently have moved into the arena of free source code or free software is really based on the idea that if they don't do that, they are not able to compete effectively with the great 800-pound gorilla that we all know in the computer field, namely Microsoft. And because of that, you see companies like IBM changing completely their strategies and developing an active participation inside the free software movement, because I think they had all read the results of events such as the losing competition of a proprietary software such as WordPerfect against a piece of software like Microsoft Word. And you know essentially why this was the case. WordPerfect, the companies, the various companies that have owned WordPerfect, eventually developed attitudes that, really quickly developed the perception that they could never get the full information, and they could never get it fast enough So, from that, it's sort of perception that you cannot compete with this 800-pound gorilla, and the perception that you can create some basic, very basic sort of platform on which you can recreate forms of competition that would obey more what the Anglophone world calls the level playing field that we were talking about in a different context this morning with Philippe, emerged, I think, this whole notion of infrastructural conceptualization. In effect, what people were trying to do is what should we really build in order to create something that is infrastructural? And when we build something infrastructural, what are we really trying to achieve? Now, I've already put forward one very important dimension of this particular infrastructural conceptualization. It is that everybody has an equal access to it, a complete, full, and just as easy access to it as anybody else. But the second question that emerged rather quickly is that, well, how far should the infrastructure extend? What kind of infrastructure do we want to build? And the basic approach to this whole question was, in a sense, what you might call a fixed vision on the whole thing. You might say, in effect, that when Torvalds began in 1991 playing with the idea of recreating something like a Unix kernel without using the Unix code, that in effect he was going to solve this notion of infrastructure once and for all in a fixed way. You might say that even before Torvalds, when Stallman wanted to do this whole system of a completely operating system for computers, he had, in effect, with the accompanying software and the equivalent of what was going to become the kernel, a vision of what the infrastructure was. And all these, let's say, approaches to the notion of infrastructure, were perfectly defensible. They were quite legitimate, quite logical, in fact. The point, though, is that the standpoint, and this was what really transpired when I did that discussion with my friend Julina, a standpoint, little by little, practically every domain has been progressively and gradually invaded. And at that point, you said to yourself, well, is all of computer science and old software infrastructural by nature? Or is there something in there that really ought to be there should be a limit on it? My answer to that is that it's neither, actually. I think what we're really seeing there is essentially a dynamic system that is beginning to be set up and to try and solve this technical problem. And what's another? I think are much more important to look at once it has been demonstrated that not only is the production possible, in fact quite efficient, one is also discovering that the number of kinds of software that could be made in effect into public domain type, GPL type forms of software is unlimited. It is in fact only limited by the ability, by the proprietary forces, to try and maintain their own territory and expand it to their own advantage. Now, the interesting thing is that I think as time goes on, and despite all the legal and all the kinds of maneuverings that we see around us taking place, I think that time is on our side, if I may say this thing, as we I think we are all on the same side in this room, at least I hope so. I don't know how many spies there are here, but I'll do as if there were no spies in this room. Hello, Microsoft spy. Whoever you may be. It's the micro. The Microsoft. Okay. So the time is on our side, because as things move on, we see clearly that sector after sector is becoming more developed, more viable, the quality increases, and sooner or later more and more organizations are seeing that there are many advantages to using these products, because precisely they offer them the full, I'm not going to go through the usual sort of mantra that free software, which you know you can point the usability to your needs, whatever, and everything. You know that better than I do. What I'm seeing right now as this series of reports of maneuvers by the companies to try and maintain the territory, to extend the territory, which are based partially on technology, but much more on legal things, appears to me more and more as something similar to what the French know as in their history as the réaction mobilière, that is, right before the French Revolution, as the economic situation was slowly shifting to a different ground. possible. I think the extensions of the copyright laws, the development of these kinds of strategies to try and bring about greater revenues for these companies and greater control, as Philippe again very rightly pointed out a minute ago, are exactly that sort of phase. So that's why perhaps I'm a bit more optimistic than you are, Philippe, because I see that as a fairly long period of time, and I see that meanwhile the technology is really working on our sides, both in terms of the development of new software and also in the way people appropriate these technologies to do things which are not always legal, but in, at the same time becoming more and more socially potent, socially effective. This is also a thought which to me is very much supported by, and this is what Frederick had asked me to deal with a little bit, with in effect precedence in the history of print. And that's where I think that again we can take some comfort in seeing what's happening right now. I don't know if you remember or not how Francis I, the French king, again reacted to the coming of printing into France, but one of his most intelligent, and being ironic, reactions was to forbid printing in the kingdom for 3 years. Now when he did that, which was, you know, he was scared by it. He was scared by it for a number of reasons. He couldn't control the circulation of documents anymore. He couldn't control those new professions emerging. He couldn't control anything at all. I mean, you were seeing all these guys, and they were the geeks of the time, you might call them. Just running around with these new strange machines, and saw these strange alliances between people that you had never seen talking to each other before, such as meteorologists and humanists. I mean, we have the same difficulties on there when you see geeks talking to people like me, for example. But the social distances luckily are a bit less nowadays than they were in the early days. Nonetheless, Francis I had the feeling that his kingdom was going every which way, because in a sense the new technology was destroying the traditional ways of controlling, for example, the production, storage, and circulation of documents. folded. Those who are doing printing in France went elsewhere to do it. First Pointer was using all the technical skill, all the geeks are doing now. You know, so you're using that thing, and that's not very good for the future of the country. Even France is the first to realize that. The second thing was that if you forbid the printed book in your kingdom, then you really have no control over it. Because it comes in clandestinely through the borders, and this clandestine carrying of books over the border was way underground, and that way was far more subversive than having a system of controls in place. And the king, in effect, after a while, realized that there were some important gains to be made by actually accepting the new technology and trying to control it as much as possible. The difference between the print and the present world is that unlike our present technologies, print had for the powers that be a very important, it's a protective belt, so to speak, which was that the investment to produce text with a press were always fairly high, so you knew that only a few people could get involved into printing, and because of that you could control those people, and that's exactly what happened over the next 2 or 3 centuries. The profession was controlled very effectively. It was in fact tied to families. The provincial forms of printing were destroyed so that most of the printers were the easiest to control and watch, namely Paris. And in that fashion, the powers of France following that recipes that were already put in place in other countries in Europe were quite successful in not only constraining and controlling that technology, but in fact leaning on it to do their own stuff, like spreading their laws and, of course, creating their ways of spreading the news and their visions of the world and so on and so forth. So there are limited comparisons that can be made that, in a sense, show that the world of print can help us understand why it not entirely the same sort of thing. My general argument is that to the extent that the world of print is generally recognized as, despite all that control, to have been a period of coinciding with a period of great expansion in the variety of ideas circulating, the kinds of theses being defended and attacked and so on, it's an intensity of the debates in this European societies that emerge with print. To the extent that despite all these controls, all that happened, and to the extent that presently the digital technologies appear to be far less controllable than the old print technologies, I would say, and we can discuss about that since I see a few heads nodding negatively, I would say that the future looks fairly hopeful. The future looks fairly interesting in these regards. Digital movie cameras. Thank you. 700 physicists, including the Frost Sweeper, named in the article, which sometimes is shorter than the list of authors. This has happened at least once in the history of science. You cannot see that these people are first thing is that, of course, the model did not emerge there. Free software did not invent the way it produces itself. It's not in Free Software that this thing was first observed. Actually, one might say, I'm not even sure there it was the first one, but it's sufficiently old and sufficiently famous to mention it. Actually, I would, as a first hypothesis, and I'm ready to be corrected on that point, is that it really emerged in the so-called scientific revolution period when scientists, these natural philosophers, as they were called at the time, in the 17th century, particularly in Western Europe, began to invent not the idea that they had to study nature, things like that. People had been studying nature forever, but decided that they were going to create a system of communication to bring about a way of checking with each other who was really doing good work and who was really moving forward in a sense on this or that or that question. Incidentally, and amusingly, the whole notion of the Republic of Science as it was developed, would not have been possible without postal systems. And it's thanks to the post office developing in Europe that from courts to courts, people were sending documents, and essentially the system was being pirated by the Republic of Letters and the Republic of Science. People were just adding a few more Franz, Father Mersenne, a friend of Descartes, was well known for that. Obviously, he had a tremendous twist to write lots of letters. And Oldenburg in Britain was the Royal Society was doing similar things. Leibniz, as you probably know, was a Stalin writer, letter writer, and so on and so forth. Some of these guys, I call them the Walters of the Republic of Science, if you consider that the postal system was the internet of the time. And you have the basics of that, but even those Walters were crumbling under the weight of the not enough bandwidth. So what they decided was to marshal the local technology that was available and adapt it to the needs. And that was, of course, using print, and that was inventing the scientific journal. And the journal was really a mechanization of the letter. And in fact, you could, you know, just print the articles and then you just dispatch them along your up to 300, 400, 500 copies. And then you were really sure that the thing was not being stolen away from you because at that point you had 300, 400, 500 witnesses all across the country. So once you have this picture in mind, what you notice is that the free software movement has done exactly the same sort of thing. When people write code, they publish it, essentially. And by publishing it, they know that that part of their code will be retained and remembered, attached to that particular person. Some of it is done very generously with very little concern about that, but other parts are not done that way. And the point is to create what sociologists generally call symbolic capital. You find these people producing code because you get reputation, authority, prestige, buys, and being known to be up to that really nifty batch in that particular part of the software in the community that is concerned about that. It's about the same as when you do that really phonemes are very interesting entities, because when you define the basic sounds of the language, there is one very interesting problem you have to solve, which is people can speak the same language with extremely varied accents. The proof is that you understand this by my question. And you have to say to yourself, how can I understand that person? Although that person, if I were to make a very, very systematic analysis of what the sound O or U and so on is not pronounced the same way as anybody else's. Why? How does that work? And the great invention of the phoneme by Saussure, linguist at the end of the 19th century, was to invent really what I call the third way to describe the world. And I need three ways to describe the universe. Sorry, people. Hopefully, any more if you do tell me, I would be interested. I'd be sort of, you know, on up the brakes. You've got the other way, which is falling a bit into disrepute recently, but we used to be quite popular. You've got the great home, you've got whatever, divinity, and then the emanations stemming out of that. We're all emanations from God, and then there are angels on top of us coming closer to God, and so on, and so on. That's really the only two ways we had until the end of the 19th century. Imagine that we had like atoms, but instead of describing these atoms by a series of qualities, which would be their predicates in effect, and this atom of iron has so much density and so on and so forth, for say, well, it differs from lead this way, it differs from copper this way, and so on and so forth. This kind of funny actually, because it might be able to define in a new way what isotopes are like, but I'll leave that to those more curious about those questions in this crowd. So, so he said that the sound in the language really exists exactly that way. We in most languages in Europe, for example, when we hear B, we distinguish it from V. entities. It's like a peer system in which you exist only to the extent that you're different from yours. Think of what we are as individuals in a society. We only exist actually to the extent that people recognize something in our difference, which is kind of interesting to them. If there is too much difference, we're crazy. So we're out and put into an asylum. If we're too similar, we're boring. Right, so we don't exist anymore either. I mean, it's probably the greatest problem for twin brothers and sisters, real twins, that they're so similar that they have to be terribly boring to each other or fuse and become fusion fantasy. And the phoning sort of creates this kind of very interesting tension between existence through resemblance and yet distinction. And in fact, again, the same sociologist used the term symbolic capital, or so was talking about the way people exist through distinction. And it may not be a pure quirk of language that we give distinctions to people that do interesting things in society. There is this sort of linguistic wisdom in this notion of distinction. Now, when you create code in Linux, when you create code in GIMP, when you create code in KDE or whatever, what are you doing? You're achieving existence through recognizable distinction. You're putting yourself into a community. Sure, you are cooperating, but you're cooperating in a way that you don't want to dissolve yourself into the community. You want to animate the community by being better than most of the people only that they have patched, nifty patch you're doing, or that they have nifty extension you're doing. You're participating in that group to the extent that group in a sense recognizes that you exist in that group. And the whole thing is moving in that way. At least that would be my contention in my thesis. I'm arguing that this whole notion, this whole dynamics that emerged with science and now seems to be extending to new walks of life. It has extended through authorship. For an author is really a distinctive individual, again, very phonemic. Very phonemic thinking, since there are many French-speaking people in this room. Think of Rousseau. So if you put together what I've been trying to say this afternoon, on the one hand, not a static vision of the infrastructure that you defend like a fortress against the encroachment of the companies, but rather as a competing dynamics of competing chemical reactions, to use my metaphor. And if you add to that on one side of these chemical reactions, you really have the full strength and the whole dynamism of what I call phonemic individualism. I think we're coming into a very fascinating world. thought in my presentation, I would argue that this probably fits more into a micro kind of approach if I use the economics kind of way of looking at things. And you're more looking at it more from the macro sort of thing, but they're not incompatible, far from it. They're very complementary. I think these are metaphors in any case, which is exactly the role of metaphors, which can stimulate investigation of this phenomena. Metaphors are exactly meant for that purpose, and that's why I'm proposing them in a future response. Marginal game, you know. And hope for the future. But if, for example, you're going to a world in which, say, everybody can really publish whatever, imagine the whole question of control would have been rigged, and it's really individual's forever. I'm not sure that individuals without a set measure of control is such a wonderful utopia. See, that's exactly my point. Unless the libertarians, for example, who think that by just pushing the mantra of ever more individualism, that I think anybody then say, I think I've been had there. I don't know who was first to be to longer because it's only through discussions among people. They're just scores of ideas that the real life of the mind will take place, not through the supports. It's funny what it is. Yeah, oh sure. Yeah. Of course.